Tonight, Michael LaBelle, professor of art history at Hunter College, City University of New York, curator and author, presents his findings on one of the modern's most popular paintings, Mr. Bellamy, by Roy Lichtenstein. Michael has a particular passion for Lichtenstein's work, currently serving on the board of directors for the Roy Lichtenstein Foundation, and some years before, having written his dissertation on the artist, which was then published as the book Image Duplicator, Roy Lichtenstein and the Emergence of Pop Art. It was published by Yale University Press in 2002. His publications also include James Rosenquist, Pop Art, Politics and History, in the 1960s, published by University of California Press in 2009, and John Sloan, Drawing on Illustration, Yale University Press, 2014, the latter of which was awarded the Smithsonian American Art Museum Charles C. Eldridge Prize for Distinguished Scholarship in American Art. As mentioned, Michael, in addition to being an educator, is a curator and a writer. As such, he has contributed numerous essays for exhibition catalogs, as well as articles for such publications as Art Journal, Art Forum, Art in America, and Art Bulletin. He has also received recognition with grants and fellowships from organizations such as the Getty Research Institute, the Henry Luce Foundation American Council on Learned Societies, and the Terra Foundation for American Art. In addition to all of this, Michael's bio significantly mentions his longtime relationship with the Whitney Museum of American Art, working with the museum's education department on programming designed to teach the public how to look at art. For tonight's presentation, Michael presents Pop and Its Sources, Reconsidering Roy Lichtenstein's Mr. Bellamy, in which he will soon reveal a new discovery, the original comic strip on which the painting was based, and the ramifications of that new information. So, with everybody on the edge of their seat, please join me in welcoming Michael LaBelle. Let's see here. Okay, technical difficulty. Oops, that's the wrong way.
Thank
Good
you.
Start.
Thank you. I know. Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening. I'm very excited to present this material. Usually when I give a talk, most of it comes out of what I've been working on, but I actually want to start with some thank yous, because what I'm going to present this evening comes out of discussions with quite a number of people. So I want to thank Andrea Tile and Justin Brancato of the Roy Lichtenstein Foundation. I want to thank Shelley Lee and Frank Avila Goldman of the Roy Lichtenstein Estate. I want to thank the scholar Avis Berman, with whom I had some very interesting conversations about this material, Barbara Castelli of the Castelli Gallery, and then finally the staff here, who's been really wonderful in welcoming me and helping me out. So John Knuckles, who's been working on audiovisual and tech, and then Amy Cardoso and Terry Thornton in education. They've really given me a wonderful welcome. So as Terry said, I want to present a kind of, well, I'll explain, it's not actually a new discovery. It's new to all of you, and I'll explain a little bit more later. But what I want to do, obviously this evening I'm going to talk about the moderns, this major painting by Roy Lichtenstein that's in the moderns collection called Mr. Bellamy, and give you a little bit of context about that painting. But before I start, a little bit about Roy Lichtenstein. Roy Lichtenstein was born in 1923 in New York City. He pursued undergraduate studies in art and graduate studies in art at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. His studies were interrupted by World War II. He served in the war. By the late 1940s, he was done with school. And then for over a decade, he sort of bounced around a lot in various places, in Columbus, Ohio, in Cleveland. And then finally, by the late 1950s, he made his way to Oswego in upstate New York, where he was teaching at the State University of New York. Now, and so I recognize that many people are familiar with Roy Lichtenstein's better-known pop artwork, but maybe less familiar with the work that he was producing in the decade before that. And so I'm just showing you two examples of the kinds of paintings he was making in the 1950s, where he was working in a kind of cubist, quasi-cubist kind of style. But very much like his later pop artwork, he was using borrowed imagery. So in both of these cases, he was looking at either well-known history paintings, as you can see on the left, or sort of lesser-known images, engravings, and prints from American history, some of which had American Indian themes, that he was again sort of transforming and translating through this kind of cubistic style he was using in that period. Now, a major moment for him, and in fact the instigator for the work that I want to talk about this evening, occurs in 1960. In the middle of that year, he leaves his job teaching at SUNY Oswego in upstate New York, and he takes a job at Douglas College, which is then the women's college of Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey. And it's at Douglas and at Rutgers a number of things happen. First of all, he comes into contact with a major group of avant-garde artists working in that period, artists like Alan Kaprow, who was one of the main figures in developing the happenings movement in the late 1950s, artists like George Siegel, and many of the artists involved with the Fluxus movement, including George Machunas and others, many of whom are working or studying, many of these artists are working or studying at Rutgers. Around that time, as you can see, Lichtenstein has moved on to a more sort of abstract expressionist, a gestural sort of abstraction kind of idiom or style in his work, as you're seeing here. He was often, I mean, he was doing more sort of mark making, like you can see here, but also many of his paintings included these kind of ribbons of paint that he was pulling across the surface with rags. And so this is what his work looked like around 1960. Around that time, maybe a year or two earlier, he was also doing a series of experiments with the kind of imagery by which he would become well known in his pop work. And as you can see here on the left, he was not only experimenting with this kind of gestural mark making that most of us who study the artwork of the time identify with the abstract expressionist movement, but occasionally he was placing these cartoon characters. We have examples of Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck or Bugs Bunny that he placed into these kinds of fields of abstract sort of gestural marks. Now, the interesting thing about the image on the left, as opposed to the right, is that on the left, this is a drawing. And as far as I know, we don't have any examples of Lichtenstein's paintings like the one on the left, because according to Lichtenstein, when he started making his pop artworks, he unstretched the painted versions of these kinds of images from their stretcher bars, and he laid them down on the floor, and he drip paint on them. He destroyed them. And artists often do this when they're working on a new, in a kind of new mode, or in transition, they destroy a kind of body of work that represents this kind of transitional moment. But we do have drawings like this one that seem to represent what he was doing around this time. Now, the big move that Lichtenstein makes, and again, I'm just setting things up for you to understand the work that I'm going to focus on today. The big move is that for Lichtenstein is that at some point in 1961, he makes this painting. Now, the art historians and the people who are interested in history in the room know that we don't always have precise ideas about exactly when certain works were made, and that's true of this work, Look, Mickey. Our understanding is that sometime in 1961, probably by June of 1961, he had made this painting on the right, which is widely considered Roy Lichtenstein's first full-fledged sort of pop art work. It's now in the collection of the National Gallery of Art in D.C. And his major move was to let go of, discard this kind of gestural mark-making that was exemplary of kind of painting in the 1950s and paint this pop imagery with this very flat, kind of uninflected surface that was very much like the printed surfaces that this imagery was ordinarily circulated through. And within in the painting in the Moderns collection, Mr. Bellamy, was, as we understand it, painted several months after Look, Mickey. And as you can see by this point, probably in the summer, mid to late summer of 1961, Lichtenstein was beginning to fully sort of explore the implications of pop art, or what we know now as pop art. He was appropriating or borrowing images from the mass media, comic strips, advertisements, eventually comic books, and painting them in a relatively flat, uninflected way, and also beginning to experiment with one aspect of his work, which would become a kind of signature identifying element of his work, which are these fields of regularized dots. They're sometimes called Bende dots. I think on a kind of more technical level, it's not exactly the correct term. And they aren't actually Bende or half-tone dots, but they're painted, fields of painted dots that mimic the half-tone or Bende dots of printed images. Now, one of the first things we would want to look at Mr. Bellamy and kind of explore is that, in fact, it shows that Lichtenstein, at the beginning of his developing this kind of idiom or style of pop art, that things weren't completely settled just yet in his work. And if we look closely at the surface of the work, which I was doing earlier today, we begin to see evidence that he was still, in this period, in the summer of 1961, he was still developing this approach. In fact, several curators, Donna DeSalva and Paul Schimmel, in the 1990s, put together a show called Hand-Painted Pop, American Art in Transition. And Mr. Bellamy, like Lichtenstein's other canvases from this short period of time, exemplify this kind of idea of hand-painted pop, because even though they seem to suggest printed images, there are all of these aspects and details that if we look closely, we see he's still developing this approach. Now, it's difficult to see in reproduction, but if you look at the surface of the painting in the galleries, you begin to see that he actually used pencil or graphite to rule out sort of lines in which to put the text in his word balloons. You can see that he was not doing very well at painting. He wasn't painting within the lines, right? He was still sort of developing this, so there's some carelessness, or he didn't really care to really make these images precise. And you can really see that there's a hand-painted quality to this painting. And also, that follows also with those fields of dots, those fields of regularized dots in the painting. In his later pop work, he would begin to use very, very refined kind of stencils to make these dots greens and these fields of dots very regularized. But in this period, as you can see, if we look in close up at the painting, it's very hand-painted. They're rather irregular. And even, you know, as I was preparing for today, I was looking at magnified images of the painting, and he's doing something which doesn't work conceptually with how half-tone dots actually work in printing. Half-tone dots are binary, right? They're either there or they're not, and you use them to suggest tonality. But what he's doing, Mr. Bellamy, it's very interesting. He's actually sort of painting some of the dots at a less sort of intense degree so that they're sort of half there. They're sort of half erased. So he's actually creating a tonal range within the dots itself, which he will not do later on, or he'll use other methods to suggest a kind of tonal range early on. So in fact, the first thing we can do when we look at Mr. Bellamy and start examining it is to see, again, that it really exemplifies this hand-painted pop moment in Lichtenstein's career, when in this period, in the first months or year of him experimenting with this new style, he was exploring the possibilities, and he hadn't fully resolved how he was going to approach this method of painting. Now, the interesting thing is that this also follows with other artists who had become known for this style, for pop art, and that's true as well of Andy Warhol. Very often when I teach and lecture about Warhol, I show several images like these two paintings that I'm showing you now, both of these paintings from 1961 by Andy Warhol. The difficulty, as Terry mentioned early on, I've written a lot about pop art. I sometimes get a little frustrated, you know, at people sort of seeing me as a pop art scholar. I think because a lot of people don't see pop art as serious, it's seeming apparent superficiality and simplicity sort of suggests that it was easy, right? That there's something extremely simplistic and direct about it. And both the aspects of Mr. Bellamy I was just showing you and these two paintings by Warhol actually show that this idea that these pop artists in the United States in the 1960s, who were preceded by groups of artists working in the UK, in England, in the decade prior, just to say that they were using borrowed or appropriated imagery from the mass media, from advertising and commercial culture, and importing it into paintings, it sounds like it's a very simple process. But Mr. Bellamy and these paintings by Warhol show that that process actually was more complex. That these artists were exploring, well, if I'm going to take an image, a pre-existing printed image from an advertisement, from a comic strip, and make it into a painting, what is that going to look like? How am I going to do that? And both Mr. Bellamy and these paintings by Warhol show that that required a process of experimentation. That early on, Warhol obviously assumed or thought that if he was going to do that, he needed to show a kind of level of artistry, of engagement, right? Artistic engagement. So he added gestural sort of strokes in the field of images. He added, well, what's the clearest example of sort of expressive gestural painting? Jackson Pollock's drips. So he's going to add drips to the kind of imagery. He's going to include some text and then leave some out. There's this sort of heavy working, heavy manipulation of the imagery through which both of these artists, Lichtenstein and Warhol, begin to explore pop art. But as they both develop their work, and you can see this in this comparison of two paintings by Warhol from about a year apart, the same subject, but as you can see, Warhol and Lichtenstein both, as they developed these approaches, which we have come to call pop art, they realized that part of that approach could mean creating imagery that was as precise and kind of hard-edged as the printed images they were borrowing or using in their work. So already just by looking at Mr. Bellamy and putting it in context of, for instance, Warhol's early pop work, we begin to get a better understanding not only of these paintings, but of the process by which these artists in the early 1960s developed this approach, which, as I said, we call pop art. Now, that's also true as well of something about the painting that I want to develop here, but I have to be honest, you know, in this presentation, I've already lied to you a little bit. I've misrepresented things by showing you Mr. Bellamy in this format. Now, if you do a Google image search for Mr. Bellamy, you'll find different variations of the image. You'll often see it presented like this. I do, any of the teachers and academics in the room will probably resonate with the realization that we're often trying to explain to our students that Google is not the be-all and end-all of scholarly research. But you'll often see Mr. Bellamy presented like this. But of course, those of you who know it well realize that I've left something out, which is that there's in fact a border around the painting. And yet again, in the first year or two of his experimentation with pop art, and you can see this in this photo of Lichtenstein in 1962 with two other paintings from this period, around this period, 61, 62, at the Leo Castelli Gallery, he drew or included this kind of border around the panel. And for me, it seems that what Lichtenstein is doing is he's emphasizing what I would call the kind of panelness, right? The reproducedness or reproductionness of that image. We all recognize those kinds of frames or panels from comic strips and comic books. And Lichtenstein is kind of telling us, he's emphasizing that he took this image from somewhere else, from that kind of a context. Now, one of the, recognition of Terry's sort of desire to keep this lecture at a certain limit, I won't go too far off topic, although my students tend to indicate in their course evaluations that I tend to ramble a little bit. But is it really rambling if it's on the subject that I'm talking about? I don't think so. So in the field of art history in the last few decades, there's a lot of focus on contemporary art, which has been good, but it's often, to me, separated recent art, art of the last few decades, from art of the past. And as I was preparing for today, I was thinking about this kind of panelness, this marking of the panel in Lichtenstein's work, and it made me think not about art of the last 50 years or so, but art of almost 500 years ago, this French engraving from the 1630s. This artist is doing something very similar. He's presenting a portrait of someone, but as you can see, he's put it in a kind of frame, and he's really emphasized that kind of framing to again suggest that this is an image which is reproduced, that lays on or is on a surface that's sitting on another surface. There's a kind of recognition of the surfaceness, of the reproducedness of this image. And Lichtenstein is not, well, we want to recognize that pop art in the early 1960s was seen by many people as something new and looked very new and different and very contemporary. Lichtenstein was not doing something completely innovative. In fact, there are longer traditions in the history of art where artists are thinking about how their work relates to reproduced images and the circulation of those images in reproduction. Now, given that Lichtenstein is telling us that his image is like a panel, it was taken from a panel, it's not surprising that very quickly after Lichtenstein's work appeared on the art scene and began to be exhibited and displayed and sold, observers began to criticize it and began to focus on this borrowing from elsewhere and began to look for the sources of Lichtenstein's images. So in 1963, really a year and a half or 2 years after Lichtenstein's work begins to circulate and be reproduced in art magazines and be shown in galleries and museums, a professor at Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley, named Earl Laron, writes an article in Art News in September of 1963 called "Pop Artists Are Copycats," which is really an attack against Roy Lichtenstein, because what had happened, as you can see here, just to explain what you're looking at, Earl Laron had written a famous book called Cézanne's Composition, in which he had diagrammed the kind of visual logic of Cézanne's paintings. Now, we could discuss the limitations of Laurent's drawing of diagrams of an artist's work who had said, Cézanne famously said, the outline escapes me. Right, so it's a little ironic that Laurent thought he could diagram these paintings through outlines. But Lichtenstein took two of the diagrams from Laurent's book, this is the original, and made paintings out of them. Now, understandably, Laurent was a little pissed off, and he wrote this article, this kind of screed, this attack on Lichtenstein, and as you can see then, the pop artists or copycats really sort of both arguing against this approach, but also, as you can see, starting to do something which became very, very common in the literature on Roy Lichtenstein's work, which you see whenever, almost invariably, when you see a major catalog or book on Roy Lichtenstein's art, you will see at least one, if not several, comparisons like this. I will, you know, say that that's true of my work as well. When I wrote my dissertation and published, which became my first book on Roy Lichtenstein, I also included these kinds of comparisons. Because again, the kind of reproducedness of Lichtenstein's work seems to call out for those of us who are interested in it, either interested in explaining it or attacking it, to find the sources of that imagery. So Laurent did that, obviously, for his own diagrams. He also did that for other work by Lichtenstein. You can see here that Laurent, later on in the article, contrasted the original panel from a Steve Roper newspaper comic strip with Lichtenstein's version, Lichtenstein's painted version of that motif. So this became, from very early on, this exploration and examination and kind of desire to find Lichtenstein's sources has really, in part, defined some of the writing about attacks on explanations of Roy Lichtenstein's paintings and his art. That has been brought to its most extreme ends by someone named David Barcelou, who for years has been tracking down Roy Lichtenstein's comic book and comic strip sources. So what I'm showing you here, and you can go on and online and find this, David Barcelou has had a succession of websites where he has paired Roy Lichtenstein's paintings and drawings. You can see he's made them, he's put them in thumbnails here with their source images from comic strips and comic books. Now, the funny thing is that Barcelou has been obsessive about this. I mean, he's been the most assiduous, the most careful documenter of Lichtenstein's sources. The curious thing is he's done this. He's devoted literally years to doing this only to attack Roy Lichtenstein. That's the point. Barcelou's point is that he wants to give credit to the artists who created the original images. And so his goal is really to show, I mean, from the title of his website, Deconstructing Roy Lichtenstein, he wants to go back and really show how much Roy Lichtenstein, relied on the work of others, the work of these comic book artists, and really give them credit, which, by the way, I want to say is an absolutely noble pursuit, and I think is really interesting, and it has really led to kind of the discovery of a lot of the sources of this imagery, and has also really built a kind of interesting debate, much of it online, about the relationship between Roy Lichtenstein's art and its sources, and whether or not we should give more credit to the artists, the comic book and comic strip artists who created the original images. Now, David Barcelou has done that for the modern's painting, Mr. Bellamy. What he's done is posted several images which he wants to suggest are the potential sources or are the potential source for the painting in the galleries here in the modern. So, for instance, he suggested that the image, the panel on the right by the artist Gil Kane is potentially a source for Mr. Bellamy. I'm here to tell you today that's not correct. I'm definitively dismissing that suggestion. He has simultaneously suggested that several panels by the famous comic artist Mill Kniff could potentially be the sources for Mr. Bellamy. Again, I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but in fact, that's not the case. And this is the point where I explained this to Terry and Amy earlier today. I have to offer to all of you a mea culpa. Now, I'm Jewish, so I'm not that versed in how to offer a mea culpa, but this will be my first public attempt. This lecture is coming maybe 15 years late. As I said, I wrote my dissertation on Roy Lichtenstein's early pop work, and I published that dissertation in slightly altered form as my first book. I finished the dissertation in 1999. I published the book in 2002. So it's, you know, a little bit of time. Now, as some of you in the audience who may be scholars or researchers realize, when you work on a big project like that, you do research that doesn't make it into the finished version, the published version. Well, this logic sort of got lost on me for about 15 years. And about a year and a half ago, I moved to a new job at Hunter College in New York City. And yet again, I was a little slow, so I took about a year and a half to unpack some of my boxes. And this past summer, I was unpacking some boxes, and I pulled out these folders, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. I haven't looked at these folders in many years. And I opened up the folder, and I realized, like, oh, I forgot about this research I did. And I made an appointment at the Lichtenstein Foundation because I thought, well, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe they know about these. And they confirmed that these images, these sources, had never been published and were unknown to the Lichtenstein Foundation, to the Lichtenstein Estate, to Andrea Teil, who oversees the Lichtenstein catalog Raisonné. And in fact, what I had done years ago and had forgotten about is that I had actually come across the source image for this painting, Mr. Bellamy. To give myself credit, which I don't always do, when I started thinking that I was going to write about Roy Lichtenstein, I knew I wanted to look at the sources, but I couldn't quite figure out, well, what would be the best way to track them down? And then I realized that, wait, Lichtenstein was teaching at Rutgers, at Douglas College, which was part of Rutgers, in this period. So I made several research trips to the Rutgers University Library and started looking at the local newspapers, which were not widely circulated. And this is why this source image has gone undiscovered for so long. So this is the source for Mr. Bellamy. This is the first time it's being presented publicly. It has never before been identified. The Lichtenstein Foundation and estate have not known it. And as far as I know, as my early correspondence with Terry indicated, the museum has not been aware of this. So this is really why I'm here today. And then I want to tell you a little bit about it. So what is this image? The image is a panel from a relatively short-lived newspaper comic strip called Thorn McBride. It only lasted for a couple of years, from around 1960 to 1962. As far as I understand it, it was published by a relatively small California-based newspaper syndicate. So it was syndicated, but it was not published in many newspapers. And the narrative was about the title character, Thorn McBride, who was the commander of a naval submarine, a nuclear submarine. And this is the strip from the summer of 1961 that Lichtenstein got the source for Mr. Bellamy from. Now, again, to give credit where credit is due, I want to just say that the artist of Thorn McBride was Mel Kiefer. He was a kind of journeyman comic artist and illustrator. He worked on comic strips. He worked on comic books. He later on went into animation. As far as I can tell from my research, he's still alive. I think he's 91. So maybe a potential Tuesday evening lecture. It might be interesting, actually, to hear him talk a little bit. I don't think he actually knows about this borrowing, even though some of the comic artists who were borrowed by Lichtenstein did later find out and do know about some of these borrowings. And, for instance, he worked on sort of major strips like the Dragnet strip that I'm showing you from the early 1950s here. Now, what is this? Now, and I can say a little bit more about this, but, you know, there's a limitation. There are limitations to kind of finding these sources. But actually, once we begin to drill down a little bit more precisely and start thinking about, and I've been doing this for the past few months, thinking about the implications of identifying the source for Mr. Bellamy, a number of interesting things emerge. So first of all, as I was preparing for today, over the past weeks and couple of months, I realized I wanted to put together a little timeline, a chronology. And so let me explain to you what you're seeing here. So these are not, just to clarify, because I know, again, as a teacher, I know sometimes I lecture about things in the classroom, and then I read my students' papers and exams and think, I don't think I said that exactly. That's a translation of what I said. So I'm not giving you the date of each of these individual paintings. Rather, each date is what an archaeologist would call a terminus postquem, which is the date after which these paintings must have been made. So the date that you're seeing is the date in which the source image appeared in the newspaper. So we know that none of these paintings could have been made prior to the date I'm giving you. Now, the interesting thing is that Look Mickey on the upper left is a little bit different because it did not come from a newspaper comic strip panel, but rather an illustration in a Disney Golden Book. So we don't have as precise a kind of date for it. But what we do know, our understanding is that Lichtenstein had painted Look Mickey by June of 1961. We know this because Avis Berman, who has worked, a scholar who's worked with the Lichtenstein Foundation, has done an extraordinary series of oral history interviews with people who knew Lichtenstein. And one of them is someone named Letty Lou Eisenhower, who worked at Rutgers and was close to Lichtenstein. And she recalls that she took a drive with Roy Lichtenstein in June of 1961. She knows the date because they were driving to Jeffrey Hendrix's, who is another figure in this scene, wedding. And that in the car, she recalls Roy describing to her in June of 1961, making Look Mickey. She also reports that she was a little distracted in the car because she had to pick up beer for the reception. So she didn't remember everything about this conversation. So we know that probably somewhere a little bit before, around June of 1961, Lichtenstein made Look Mickey. And then later on in the summer of 1961, at the very least, what we know is that he was looking very intently for comic strip panels. He was looking through the newspaper, perhaps daily, to find panels to create these new kinds of paintings that he was thinking about making. And again, in preparing for coming and talking to all of you about this material this evening, I was looking at this timeline and thinking about it, and I thought, there was something that sort of struck me in the gut, like, but why the summer? Why summer of 1961? It was just something that caught me. And then I realized, any of you who are teachers or academics in the room, he was teaching art on the college level. I think, now this is just a hypothesis. I think he waited until the semester was over to start working on these paintings. And in fact, what I've been talking with Avis Berman, this kind of scholar, about is that, in fact, this sort of hypothesis makes even more sense because the previous summer, the summer of 1960, he was selling a house, buying a new house in New Jersey, and moving from upstate New York to New Jersey. He had a family and two young sons. He probably just didn't have the time. So I have this feeling that what Mr. Bellamy and these other paintings of the summer of 1961 represent are this major moment, this major push that Roy Lichtenstein, who, by the way, Terry and I were talking about this earlier, and she described him as a young artist when he became a pop artist. No, he was in his late 30s. He was around 38 when he was doing these paintings. He was late in his career. He had worked for more than a decade, kind of exploring and experimenting and trying to discover who he was as an artist. And I think the summer of 1961, a moment when perhaps he suddenly had a little bit of, not for those of us who teach, probably not too much unrestricted time, but a little unrestricted time, he directed his energy towards painting this new series of work. And now, understanding this timeline, we can place this painting in the Moderns collection, Mr. Bellamy, in this major early moment in Lichtenstein's career where he's really developing the work that will bring him to fame. Now, I'm very aware, as I mentioned earlier, that in my field, in my profession, in art history, there is some skepticism about doing what I'm doing now. There's a kind of derogatory, pejorative term, source hunting, right? We often talk about it when someone's looking at the iconography of art or doing what I'm doing now. This idea that if I find the source, the origin of a work of art that I'm interested in, it somehow explains things. That's it. We wrap everything up and we conclude. And again, in preparing for today, I realized that, in fact, no. Even though I came here very excited and happy to present to you this new or old new discovery, which gives a kind of new context for Roy Lichtenstein's Mr. Bellamy, what I want to conclude with and leave you with is that, in fact, finding this source for the painting does not close things down, does not conclude, but rather opens things up. In fact, for me, it poses a series of questions, a series of three kind of questions, which we could actually sort of call, in the parlance of sort of scholarship or art history, sort of methodological questions about how we read images and how we look at works of art. So I want to leave you with three sort of major series of questions so that even when some of you, I know the museum's going to be closed, but if you come back and look at the painting in the context of what I'm presenting for you right now, you're not left with just kind of, oh, we've answered everything and wrapped it all up, but a series of questions. First of all, a very interesting question, which is, if we're going to indicate that Roy Lichtenstein was finding in the newspaper comic strips in 1961 sources or motifs or inspiration for paintings, the question that I have is, was Lichtenstein just interested in the singular image that he would turn into his painting, or was he interested in the narratives, right, the stories, the storylines that were being presented in the strips that those singular panels were part of? So in fact, we can maybe not look just at that one strip from which Mr. Bellamy was taken, but let's step back a little bit, several days. So the storyline that winds up in the panel that Lichtenstein borrows from Mr. Bellamy is about this title character of the strip, Thorne McBride, who again is a naval commander, being instructed by a superior, right, to go consult on a movie set. And what's happening is there is a movie being filmed in Italy, and the filmmakers have been able to work it so that they are filming on an actual naval submarine. Okay, so you see here, pretty sweet Mr. Faber snagging a real sub as a prop, okay? So the story of the strip that Mr. Bellamy comes from is Thorne McBride, the naval commander, encountering this film director or filmmaker. That's the Charles Faber that's being discussed, who he's going to sort of consult with. And in fact, in a later, I didn't bring it with me, but in a later panel, they sort of have a conflict. And so I was interested in this storyline for two reasons. One, this places us deeply within sort of Cold War politics, the nuclear age, the nuclear submarine, sort of military conflict, which we could place Lichtenstein's 1960s pop art into the context of. But also, it's a storyline about the conflict or kind of interface between real and fake. Okay, the real naval commander appearing on this film set, which is developing a film, filming a movie about the Navy and the kind of conflict they're in, which is precisely, right, real and fake, represented and sort of reality. That's the subject of most art, and specifically Roy Lichtenstein's art, the real and the represented, or the kind of depicted, okay? So, but to me, I don't know, I'm here to say, I don't actually know the answer to this, and I don't know necessarily the implications exactly of this. Was Roy Lichtenstein, I mean, the simple way of asking this is, was Lichtenstein actually reading these comic strips? Were the storylines and the stories that he borrowed these images from important to him and important to his art? I have a kind of provisional answer for this. In fact, in my book on Lichtenstein, I do reproduce some other episodes in comic books where it looks like he was interested in the broader context. But for Thorne McBride and for this early pop work that Mr. Bellamy represents, the jury's still out. I'm not sure. But again, a kind of question about the placement of this painting and this work by Lichtenstein back into the context from which it was derived. Number two, you'll notice if you look at the word balloon, one of the most evident changes is in the name of the character to which this figure, this military figure, this naval figure is referring. In the original comic strip, it's Charles Faber, who's a director who's working on this film set. In the painting, he says, I'm supposed to report to a Mr. Bellamy. I wonder what he's like. Now, in the literature on Lichtenstein in this painting, this has generally been taken to refer to one specific figure, a kind of major influential figure in art of the 1950s and 1960s in New York, Richard or Dick Bellamy. He was this kind of incredibly sort of energetic, vivacious figure. He was at the center of a number of circles. And in the fall, late fall of 1960, he had opened a gallery in New York called the Green Gallery. He was this really, really interesting figure, a kind of difficult and complex figure. He was, in fact, biracial. His mother was from China. His father was from Ohio. He had a very interesting history. And then in 1960, after a succession of other involvements in the art world, particularly in New York, he opens this gallery, the Green Gallery, just a few months prior to the invitation I'm showing you there. And he was really involved with some major, major kind of aspects of art in the 1960s. Those of you who know the history of pop art, the history of a figure like Klaus Oldenburg, know of Oldenburg's store, which was a major gesture he made in the 1960s, sort of using the storefront on the Lower East Side to actually make and sell, as if he was an actual shopkeeper, these kind of very distinctive plaster sort of objects. And as you can see, Oldenburg's store was created or developed in cooperation with Richard Dick Bellamy's Green Gallery. And so when we look at, oh, and I do want to point out that if you're interested at all in this period or this figure, there's this wonderful book that appeared about 2 years ago by Judith Stein that's a biography, really interesting biography of Richard Bellamy. Now, because Bellamy was a significant figure at this time, artists made portraits of him. So Alex Katz made this portrait of Richard Bellamy in 1960. George Siegel did a sculptural cast of Richard Bellamy in 1964. But getting back to this point I made about questions, I want to point out that Lichtenstein's painting is not a portrait, right? In fact, it's a very strange kind of representation, because even though it may indicate a reference to Richard Bellamy, although, by the way, it doesn't say a first name, so the reference is even more open than that, it's about not showing him or not seeing him. So it's not a portrait, nor is it a kind of homage to a major art world figure like this work, which is in the galleries at the Modern. I was just upstairs looking at it earlier. This is a Dan Flavin work, which is an homage, a kind of work that references Leo, the great art dealer Leo Castellari, in long respect and affection. But Lichtenstein's painting is not that. It's not a portrait. It's not an homage. And it reminded me of something else Lichtenstein was doing just probably a few months later. Ivan Karp was another important figure in the art world at the time. He was working with Leo Castelli. He was one of the people who was really, really part of the kind of moment in which pop art in the United States, in New York, is identified and kind of discovered. And probably in the fall of 1961, so a few months after Lichtenstein makes the Mr. Bellamy painting, Lichtenstein produces this picture, this portrait of Ivan Karp. And so here, okay, here's Roy Lichtenstein making perhaps a more direct or conventional portrait of an art world figure. No, it's never that simple. Because at the same time Lichtenstein makes that portrait of Ivan Karp, he makes this painting, this portrait of Alan Kapper. And there have been indications in the literature on Lichtenstein that, in fact, he planned 10 versions of these, although gave up after these two. But between those two pictures and Mr. Bellamy, we're getting a suggestion of someone who is actually, I mean, what you get from the portraits of Ivan Karp and Alan Kapero is someone who's not interested, not willing in producing a direct representation of a figure. In fact, he's avoiding it, right? He's making fun of that idea by producing an almost identical repetition and labeling it with two different names. And so there's a kind of way in which we're already seeing with Mr. Bellamy, if we put it up in relation in the context of other experiments that Lichtenstein is working on at the time, we're getting some insight into perhaps an avoidance or a tendency to trouble or problematize the representation of individuals or visual representation itself, which brings me to my last point, this last question I want to open up about this painting, which I think is very interesting and really complicates our understanding of Roy Lichtenstein's art. Look, as I said, I've worked a lot on pop art. I kind of get my feathers ruffled when people say, oh, Michael Lobel, the pop art scholar, because I always think it sounds like, you know, I don't have, you know, enough chops, right? I'm not a scholar of Cézanne or abstract expressionism. I'm a scholar of pop art. And that's the problem with pop art, is that it looks superficial. It looks easy. It looks very direct. Right? It looks like it wasn't worked on. And that's one of the problems or issues with looking at Lichtenstein's work. But I want to just draw you back. And so it's very difficult for people to even see sort of content or a kind of thinking in this work. And so what I want to do finally is put Mr. Bellamy within a body of works, all from that period in 1961, all that were probably the initial gestures of Roy Lichtenstein sort of working through this approach to pop art. But I want to point out something to you about what all of these share. They don't only share the fact that they're borrowed images. They don't only share the fact that Roy Lichtenstein is experimenting with making paintings that look similar or have similar elements to printed imagery. Each of these images is about a kind of frustration and avoidance, particularly of vision and seeing. So I want you to look at these with a different set of eyes and point out, for instance, that Look, Mickey, which is widely seen as Lichtenstein's initial pop work, is about a figure who doesn't see himself. Actually, he thinks he's seeing something, but what he's not seeing is what he's done to himself. Or this painting, I think one of the most interesting paintings in the series of early pop paintings by Lichtenstein, which includes a figure looking directly out at us but says that he sees no one, right? Which is kind of erasing us as viewers. I can see the room, but there's nobody in it. And then these three pictures, which were probably painted or at least conceived around the time, which refer to things definitively, emeralds or an engagement ring or Mr. Bellamy by name. So there's an interesting tension between an image and text or language, but that are unseen by us. They're off screen or off panel. And in fact, if you start looking at Lichtenstein's, even early on in this development and experimentation with pop, Lichtenstein is using these borrowed imagery, these borrowed images, to explore a certain range of subject matter and a certain set of concerns. Now, why? Why was he doing that? Like, why these kinds of references? Again, as I said, I'm not quite clear. I think one of the things is, that's interesting is that you could say that he's at a moment of transition, right, in his career where he doesn't quite know. He doesn't know where these works are going to lead him. He had no idea, I'm sure, at this moment, that these works would launch him to kind of national and international fame. So perhaps on some level, they represent a kind of a confusion or not knowing about things. They may do that. That's a kind of more biographical reading. I also think what they may do is be a response to the reigning art movement in the United States a generation earlier, which is abstract expressionism. The strange thing about abstract expressionism is it purports to allow us to see something internal about the artist. The artist expresses something on the surface of the canvas, right? We see Jackson Pollock's drips or Willem de Kooning's sort of, or Franz Kline's gestures, and we're told that they're expressive. They express something. If you really think about that notion, the rhetoric of expressionism in art, it's absurd. How does inert matter, right, paint, which is basically colored dirt, express anything internal? And of course, generations of art historians have launched critiques of this idea of expression or expressiveness. And it's, what's interesting about these paintings is, again, they're expressing or communicating a kind of difficulty of recognition, a kind of confusion, things that are unseen or unseeable. And that may also be a part of what Lichtenstein was trying to communicate in these works. But again, what I want to say is I don't exactly know, and I want to leave some of this unknown or unexplained, because, in fact, that's sort of my purpose this evening. My primary and sort of manifest goal was to present to all of you here at the museum, the source, finally the definitive source, that Roy Lichtenstein used to make this painting, Mr. Bellamy. But my implicit or less than implicit goal was to do something else, which is to take a work of art that I know because I've worked on these types of works for years, that when people walk into the galleries and look at that painting, it looks simple. It looks superficial. It looks easily graspable in a moment. It's borrowed from a comic panel. What could be complex about it? And what I've tried to do this evening is place that work back in a context, not only the direct context of the source image that Lichtenstein based the painting on, but a larger context, a subcultural context in the art world, a much longer art historical context, to try to show that this painting communicates, develops ideas, in various ways through various kinds of references, and in that way represents a very, very interesting moment in an artist's career as he was working through ideas that would lead him to the next major phase of his career. Thank you. So, should I see if there are any questions? Do we have a few minutes? Yes.
I guess I've always understood that by taking one panel out of a comic book or out of a story, you're snipping out of time, taking out of place. There's an ambiguity, like the engagement ring. We don't know, is this good, is this bad? You know, we're making the rest of the story ourselves around this, and that's kind of the abstraction, is the placement. And blowing out of proportion, that there's this one panel out of all of these, and he picked this one for some reason. That's the justification.
Yeah. So he was, and I think that's, you know, something I didn't really talk about a lot, but in part what these artists were doing, including Lichtenstein, were bringing narrative and imagery back into art through kind of a back door. By borrowing the imagery, they were bringing this kind of figuration, but also storytelling or narrative,
making it important out of ordinary proportion.
Exactly.
Wrapping fish and
that's why it's interesting. I mean, that's why I think these conversations about the artists who made the source images are interesting. Is that it absolutely is true that we want to pay attention to what they were doing. At the same time, they had different intentions and different goals. Right, they were working in different contexts. They were producing, you know, these often daily comic strips under deadline, etc. And the fact of the matter is that whatever Lichtenstein's intention, in some ways, his work itself kind of drew attention back to the original sources. So at the very least, it kind of gave a kind of avenue for people like David Barcelo and others to kind of start looking more closely at the artists who are making that work. Yeah. Yes?
I have two questions. But first, I want to thank you for presenting us with the source for this.
My pleasure. Image.
The first question is, to my way of thinking, it's very unusual for Lichtenstein to take a comic strip source that's in black and white and translate it into color. Usually he's working from color to color, says he.
So the thing that we need to make a distinction with is this first early sort of effort, and then the later works, which were from comic books, right? So yes, so some of the early comic strip panels may have been Sunday comic strips, which would have been in color. That's correct. But some of them, the daily strip would have been in black and white. But when he moves to, so within a short amount of time, he recognizes that he can also do this with comic book panels. And that's when, you know, he also begins to get involved more deeply with, you know, dealing with translating color as well. It's interesting, I did not bring it with me, but you can find online the source for Look Mickey. And the interesting thing about that is that it's a sort of a four-color illustration from a printed book. So the coloration in the original illustration is actually much more complex than in Lichtenstein's painting. So he actually simplifies it. And he's really thinking a lot. I mean, when you read his interviews, it's very interesting. He was thinking about the art of printed imagery. So for instance, he talks a lot, I don't have any examples here, but he talks about how you can use blue, you can as black, right? So, and he actually does a number of, they're more object paintings where he uses just the color blue, but he uses it as a kind of dark to save, because in printed imagery, if you can save a color, right? You don't have to use so many colors, you can save on ink. So he's thinking about some of these logics of what printed imagery, you know, how it works. I mean, I think the most extreme criticism of him is he didn't care at all about illustration, comic book art. He didn't know anything about it, and he was just a kind of image thief. I don't think he was like super, you know, he was not a big fan of it and he wasn't making this homage to it. But it is clear that he had some awareness of some of the limitations and the restrictions, and he was going to play with that in his art. And did you have a...
Just a comment on your comment. It just fascinates me. He went from that black and white to, you know, basically the primary colors plus black and white. I mean, it's like a Mondrian.
Yes, and I was looking, right, I was in the galleries earlier today and looking at it, and he's, you know, it's very... He's thinking about Mondrian. He's thinking about primary colors. He's sort of, and you can see, but then again, he plays with it. So in Engagement Ring, he only uses red, yellow, black. He's kind of figuring out how to limit these things. And then, you know, this idea of the primaries becomes important to the kind of early pop artwork. So yeah, and I really didn't, you know, and that's the danger with focusing on this kind of image hunting, is that he was deeply involved with the history of art. So he was, I mean, as I pointed out, his work in the 1950s, he was really a kind of follower of Picasso and Picasso's cubism. And it, you know, I mean, he made a lot of work, but he didn't have the kind of breakthrough, obviously, that he did around 1961. And so Picasso, Mondrian, and some of his pop work within the first years of the 1960s is clearly sort of references to some of these artists. And I didn't come up with these comparisons, but for instance, he does a golf ball, which looks like a Mondrian plus and minus painting, which Diane Waldman, a curator who curates a big Wittgenstein retrospective in the 90s, sort of points out. So yeah, he's clearly thinking about art history.
The second question had to do with this idea of portraiture. And I've always read this as more of a kind of surrogate portrait of Lichtenstein himself,
right,
particularly because he had been in the military, as you mentioned, and going through a young artist who's thinking about gallery representation and so forth.
You know, I was talking with Terry about this earlier today, and the curious thing is that if you do read it as a kind of self-portrait, it's curious that he chose Dick Bellamy as the figure that he's sort of reporting to. Like, I find it, and that's one of the questions I've been thinking about a lot. Like, I mentioned to someone a few weeks ago, like, as I was talking this through, like, well, wouldn't it have made more sense to say I'm supposed to report to a Mr. Castelli? For those of you who don't know, Leo Castelli was the, you know, really, you know, he had taken on Jasper Johns in the late 1950s. He was really... And eventually Lichtenstein does get taken on by Castelli. And this person said, well, that would have been too, the name Castelli is too specific. So Bellamy, and I probably shouldn't bring this up because I know this is being recorded. And I don't like to hypothesize too much or like engage in too many flights of fancy. But in preparing for today, I was thinking about Bellamy. And once you do accept that he just puts the name Mr. Bellamy up there, it becomes a kind of more general reference, and you take it out of the specific reference to Dick Bellamy. Probably the best known Mr. Bellamy in American culture at the time was the actor Ralph Bellamy. And I was doing some newspaper research on this in the last few weeks, and Ralph Bellamy was best known at the time. He had appeared in this major play on Broadway where he had played FDR, which got turned into a film, and in early 1961, I mean, again, back to this issue I talked about the encounter between the real and the represented, or the real and the fictional, Ralph Bellamy appears in the role of, in costume as FDR at an event with JFK in early 1961. So you literally have this encounter between a fictitious president played by an actor and a real president who was claimed in the early 1960s to be a little bit too fictional or advertised himself. I sort of discarded that from my comments this evening because I thought that, speaking of, you know, going off on a tangent, but I mean, I do think if someone were going to develop this a little bit more, not me, you know, I have my book on Lichtenstein. That's enough for me. But the reference to a Mr. Bellamy, and I thought about Bellamy in French, you know, what could the other kind of references have been? So you don't have to limit it to Richard or Dick Bellamy. You don't have to limit it to the specific, because that limits it, again, getting back to this issue of sort of art historical methodology, that limits it to this very specific New York artistic subculture. So what does that name, what could that name mean in other contexts? So I agree with you, on a more limited sort of biographical or autobiographical level, you could read this as a kind of self-portrait of Lichtenstein reporting to or looking for gallery representation. I worry that's a little too limited and restrictive. And I think what I've been trying to show about these works in general is I think this is an artist, I don't even think, I know, that this was an artist who was kind of using this imagery but to think things through in various kind of directions.
I have one question.
Yes.
Mine is more of a natural aspect, I guess. What kind of peregrination did he have to go through to obtain permission to use these art images?
So the question is, what efforts did Roy Lichtenstein have to make to get permission to use these cartoons? He got no permission to use these cartoons. And in fact, it's funny that we should talk about this because just last night I was in New York teaching a graduate class, graduate seminar, and had the good fortune to have the artist Glenn Ligon, who's a major contemporary artist, come to talk to my students last night. And he was talking about this problem of permission. It's a huge problem for artists nowadays. In this period, these artists were not that concerned with it. And in fact, you can gauge the developing profile of these artists and the pop art movement by the extent to which they begin to get legal threats against them. And so early on, none of them are getting permission. They're making these paintings. I'm sure Lichtenstein wouldn't have even thought, like, these were newspaper panels. As someone said, sort of, you know, newspaper is an ephemeral material. It's used for wrapping fish and, right? So I doubt that there was any thought to obtaining permission. As time goes by and these works begin to get shown, and particularly they get reproduced, people then, and that's the point, I mean, to go back, that's the point that the art historian, the scholar Earl Laron is sort of making here, you know, where Lichtenstein has taken a Laron diagram. He actually did this twice and used it to make a painting. There was no permission at all. But as time goes on, and as we get closer to the present, artists begin to get caught up more and more in these problems of copyright and permission. And the ironic thing is that, I mean, it's not ironic, it's an interesting sort of inverse relationship. In the age of the internet, the more easily images circulate in the world, the more the owners of those images try to clamp down on them. Because images now are more widely circulated, so there are more opportunities for the person who made the original image to see the artist's work and say, wait, someone just stole from me. So that I have students who have been interested in this. I have students who have legal training who get very interested. There are whole sort of areas of art history that where people write about and deal with art and the law. And it's a very kind of thorny set of questions. But the short answer is that when Roy Lichtenstein does this in 1961, I can't say for sure, but I would say almost 99%, he really had no concern about it. Because also, he, at this point, would not have even known where these paintings would be going. Meaning that he did not at this point, I would say in the summer of 1961, he did not yet have gallery representation, and he wouldn't have even known if they would be shown widely, let alone reproduced, let alone purchased and wind up in a museum. It was not correct. It was not. I can comment on this because I'm the black sheep of my family. I'm an art historian, but my father and two of my siblings are lawyers. So I can say, yes, it was not as litigious an age. Yes, there's more of an awareness of the possibility of actually suing someone for for something like this.
Do you think by changing the name here or changing the name in other ones to Brad and things?
I don't think by
doing that, I'm not copying.
I don't think he changed the name for those reasons. I think he had strategic reasons for kind of doing those things. Yeah, Terry.
Just to return to the notion of this kind of insider commentary with his work, referencing the art world, I always think of the painting of the brushstroke.
Yeah.
That is, I assume, and I think I've probably read, is in some way referencing abstract expression.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the first brushstroke painting comes from a comic book panel. Actually, from a horror comic book. Yeah. In fact, that is a point, that's the point in my writing on Lichtenstein early on where I argue that he was looking at the context of the story, because the story he gets that first brushstrokes painting from is a horror story about this painter who struggles and can't get success, and he paints this portrait, and then the portrait starts talking to him and haranguing him, and he stabs the portrait, he slices the picture, and he reads in the newspaper the next day about a man who's died who looks exactly like this picture he just slashed. And the painter then goes on and sort of holds himself in his studio and paints the same picture over and over and over again. And what I point out at the end of my book is that in some ways, that's Lichtenstein's story, because Lichtenstein was a painter who became utterly connected to and identified with repetition and duplication. Now, that may have been a slightly poetic sort of gesture on my part, but I'll accept that, actually. I think it sort of holds in that case. But as I said, I think it really is a kind of interesting open question, like how much Lichtenstein was attuned to these stories, to the storyline. That I'm not sure about exactly.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So thank you all for coming out. Thank you so much.